Today, we will be discussing actionable strategies in community oncology to achieve equity in triple-negative breast cancer. This is presented by Creative Educational Concepts, which is supported through an independent educational grant from Gilead. I'm Sonia Reed, and I'm an assistant professor at Vanderbilt in the Division of Hematology and Oncology. So the learning objectives today will be to, one, employ strategies to promote equitable care and outcomes for all patients with triple-negative breast cancer; two, evaluate clinical trial data for antibody-drug conjugates as part of the evolving and expanding triple-negative treatment calculus, including some of our recent FDA approvals and updated guidelines and recommendations. And then third, we'll delve into evidence-based treatment plans with an emphasis on the placement of novel therapeutics as part of equitable care for patients treated with triple-negative breast cancer. So let's start off with a little background on triple-negative breast cancer, which is defined essentially by lack of estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor, and HER2 amplification. Triple-negative breast cancer overall accounts for approximately 15% of breast cancers and is more commonly seen in younger patients, patients of African and Hispanic ancestry, as well as patients with BRCA1 germline mutations. What we know is that patients that have triple-negative breast cancer have worse survival outcomes compared to other types of breast cancer, inherently because these cancers are usually more aggressive and have a higher risk of both local as well as distant recurrence. And historically, the issue or the challenge and why we see these worse survival outcomes have truly been because of the limited treatment options for these patients. So we know that triple-negative breast cancer does have somewhat of an intrinsic heterogeneity that has been both a challenge as well as an opportunity as we think about drug development. Traditional chemotherapy has really been the backbone for what we deploy when we think about treatments for triple-negative breast cancer. However, we know that there's been search for actionable treatment targets as we try to kind of unpack that. And that has really stemmed from, as you can see here on the in the graphic, when we start looking at the different types of triple-negative subtypes from basal-like 1, basal-like 2, mesenchymal, luminal androgen receptor, and trying to figure out, can we target these subtypes as we try to improve survival outcomes. So I know I glanced over the fact that we do see some racial and ethnic differences when we think about the incidence of triple-negative breast cancer, and I kind of wanted to unpack that a little more. So when we think about triple-negative breast cancer, I think I mentioned earlier that there's a higher incidence. Triple-negative breast cancer is more prevalent in Black females compared to other racial and ethnic groups. Worldwide, we see higher rates in the U.S. as well as in patients of West African ancestry, up to 25%. And that is in comparison to even lower when we think about lower, even half of that when we think about Caucasian patients. And there's some thought that perhaps that contributes to the excess breast cancer-related mortality and the racial survival disparity that we see when we think about breast cancer survival and the differences that we see across racial groups. We know as well that triple-negative breast cancer disproportionately affects younger patients. And we also know that there's some variability when we look at the different frequencies of BRCA1 and BRCA2 across white compared to Black patients as described here. So there's a higher mortality for Black females with triple-negative breast cancer. The median age of death due to breast cancer is approximately 68 years when we think about all patients. But then when we look at white patients, that's up at 70 years. And then when we look at Black females, that is 63 years. So we see, of course, that we see a lower age of death when we look at Black patients with breast cancer. So when we think about risk factors for triple-negative breast cancer, these could be modifiable as well as non-modifiable risk factors. So that could include early menarche and or late menopause, young age at first pregnancy, African-American or Hispanic ancestry, patients that have an underlying BRCA1 mutation or family history of breast cancer, as well as patients that are obese, especially younger patients that are obese, patients with high alcohol consumption, or patients that have low physical activity and perhaps have also used hormone replacement therapy. So when we think about modifiable risk factors, because of course, some of these risk factors, you can change your family history and you can change the fact that you're born with a germline BRCA1 mutation, for example. However, we know that when we look at this list, there are quite a few modifiable risk factors, and these seem to be more prevalent in certain at-risk communities. We know that patients with low socioeconomic status, which includes the patients that perhaps are under or uninsured, seem to be associated with patients that have more advanced stage disease at diagnosis, and that's for all patients, both across different race and ethnic groups. We do, however, know that outcomes for Black patients are influenced by underlying disease characteristics as well as socioeconomic status and patterns of care. So were they able to access equitable high-level care? All those things play into the survival outcomes that we will see. So I think from what I want to kind of emphasize here is that there are biological as well as socioeconomic causes of racial disparities. So we mentioned earlier that perhaps certain groups have higher rates of BRCA1 mutations. We see that Black patients have more triple-negative breast cancer, but that cannot be, I can't overemphasize the fact that there are a lot of socioeconomic factors that kind of tie into some of the downstream effect that we see with patient having higher rates of triple-negative breast cancer, as well as higher mortality rates from triple-negative breast cancer. So despite this racial disparity that we are discussing, the fact that patients, not only are they more likely to get triple negative breast cancer, but they're more likely to die from breast cancer overall, when we think about Black patients, that is, we see low rates of clinical trial participation among these patients. So clinical trial enrollment is lowest among Black patients, as you can see here from this graph. And in a survey of over 350 trials, Black patients represented, I would say, approximately 3% of patients in pharmaceutically sponsored trials. When we looked at the SWOG studies, they were about 9%, despite the fact that Black patients make up about 12 to 13% of our population. Really kind of, you know, hone in on the fact that we need to do something to increase our clinical trial enrollment rate, especially in this group of patients that we just said have higher incidence as well as higher mortality rates. In a study, about 230 oncology trials from 2008 to 2018, where race was reported. So of course, that's another issue for another time. But of course, we could only look at the ones that race was reported. We see again that Black patients were underrepresented in these studies that led to FDA approvals. Again, this is something very concerning, especially when we look at the trials that were specifically designed for triple negative breast cancer. And what's interesting, and you know, I won't go over all of this data here, that patients will say Black patients once offered clinical trials said they were just as willing to be a part of the study. But again, sometimes these patients were not offered a clinical trial opportunity. And again, that really just brings it back to the forefront that we really should just be offering clinical trials to all of our patients. I do want to kind of, you know, go over the second bullet point here, which was to really delve into the patients that did not decide to enroll in a clinical trial, the reasons that they documented. And the main reason, as you see here, was just desire for another treatment. 20% said they just were not interested. But again, you see here, the reasons documented may not be what we think are some of the reasons why patients did not decide to be a part of a clinical trial. So I'm switching gears now to talk about a novel therapeutic era, so to speak, as we think about antibody drug conjugates and triple negative breast cancers and how these novel therapeutics has really revolutionized how we treat our patients with triple negative breast cancer. So here we'll talk about the treatment landscape for patients with metastatic triple negative breast cancer in 2023. And here I'll highlight briefly first line treatment, which includes immunotherapy, but of course, this is guided by PD-L1 status. So what this means is that any patient with metastatic triple-negative breast cancer should receive PD-L1 testing to determine whether they have a CPS score of 10 or higher. And these patients then will receive pembrolizumab plus chemotherapy. Patients that have a PD-L1 of less than 10, a PD-L1 CPS of less than 10 will then receive standard of care, single agent chemotherapy, and options range from a taxane to a platinum agent, for example. We, however, know that we do have data in the first line setting for patients to receive a PARP inhibitor if they have a germline BRCA1 or 2 mutation. So again, not only should a patient receive next generation sequencing to identify PD-L1 status, but patients that are diagnosed with metastatic TNBC should be receiving germline testing to determine whether or not they have a germline BRCA1 or 2 mutation, because these patients derive benefit from PARP inhibitors, and that has been shown to be superior to chemotherapy from the OlympiA and EMBRACA studies. Of course, the second line space is the focus of the talk today, where we will be talking about the two ADCs that have been approved, namely sacituzumab govitecan and trastuzumab deruxtecan. So what are antibody drug conjugate? So the idea of antibody drug conjugate is once an antibody drug molecule recognizes a tumor antigen, it binds to that transmembrane antigen and becomes internalized via receptor-mediated endocytosis. It is then trafficked to the lysosome, get degraded, and releases this payload that we talk about. And this is really the novelty, so to speak, of why these therapies are so effective. Sacituzumab is a first-in-class TROP2-directed antibody drug conjugate, and essentially we know that TROP2 is expressed in all subtypes of breast cancer. However, it's linked to worse outcomes. So these patients that have TROP2 expression usually are thought to have poor prognosis. Sacituzumab govitecan is distinct from the other ADCs in that it has an antibody highly specific for TROP2, and we know that it has a high drug-to-antibody ratio. We know that we got regular approval by the FDA in April 2021 for metastatic TNBC, due to the fact that there was clinical benefit seen when sacituzumab was compared to MD choice chemo, irrespective of the level of TROP2 expression. And I think that's key here as we think about the idea that this is for all patients, despite what their TROP2 expression was. So the study that led to the FDA approval was the ASCEND trial. And essentially, patients with metastatic breast cancer were enrolled if they had two or more prior lines of chemotherapy. One line could include progression within 12 months of neo or adjuvant therapy for patients that were diagnosed in the localized setting. And these patients were randomized to either receive sacituzumab or MD choice chemotherapy, where the primary endpoint was PFS in patients without brain mets, and a secondary endpoint was PFS in the overall cohort, as well as overall survival and objective response rate, duration of response, as well as safety data. The trial was halted early based on efficacy, and we will go over some of these curves here. So as we can see here, there is what was a clear separation of the curve favoring sacituzumab govitecan, where patients had an improvement in median PFS of 5.6 months compared to 1.7 months in patients that receive standard chemotherapy. And when we looked at overall survival, we again saw that that did correlate with a median OS advantage from 12 months compared to patients that received chemotherapy of 6.7 months. And again, statistically significant with a median with a hazard ratio of 0.48. So I do want to look at a subgroup analysis, if you may, of the ASCEND study looking at patients that identified as Black. So approximately 12% of patients in this trial self-reported as Black, which, as we would recall from the discussion earlier, when we think of the overall breast cancer population, that represents about 12 to 13% Black patients. But we did say that triple-negative breast cancer was more common among Black patients. So you would almost expect a higher number, especially if this trial, of course, only enroll patients with triple-negative breast cancer, you would expect that number to be higher. But be it as it may, we had 12% in the ASCEND study. So when we looked at this, the data from the patients that identified as Black, we saw pretty similar benefits as it relates to progression-free survival as well as overall survival, with PFS advantage seen from 5.4 months, compared to 2.2 months. And again, that's also seen with the overall survival advantage of 13.8 months compared to 8.5 months of patients that received standard of care chemo with a hazard ratio of 0.64. And the safety profile was similar in the arm that received ADC compared to patients that received chemotherapy. So again, want to take a dive now looking at some of the adverse side effects seen compared, and that's looking at when we're comparing standard of care chemo to sacituzumab govitecan. And what we will see here is that the most common side effect that was seen overall was neutropenia, and all grade, about 63%, compared to 43% all grade in the chemotherapy arm. And then, of course, we see diarrhea here, all grade, about 59%, compared to 12% in the chemotherapy arm. And again, dose reductions due to significant treatment side effects were 22% compared to 26% for patients that got chemotherapy. So pretty similar. Adverse events, however, that led to treatment discontinuation were actually low, 4.7 compared to 5.4% for the patients that received chemotherapy. And there were no severe cardiovascular side effects noted, which is which is important to mention. And there was no grade higher than grade 2 neuropathy or grade 3 ILD noted with sacituzumab govitecan. So we will switch gears now to talk about the second antibody drug conjugate approved in the second line setting for patients with metastatic triple negative breast cancer, which is trastuzumab deruxtecan, which is approved for patients with HER2 low metastatic breast cancer. So how common is HER2 low disease? We know that approximately 60% of patients with breast cancer are HER2 low. However, it is more common in patients that have hormone receptor positive disease. However, we know that it is also seen approximately in about a third of patients with triple negative breast cancer and about two thirds of patients with HR positive breast cancer. So the study that led to the approval of trastuzumab deruxtecan is the DESTINY-Breast04 study, which essentially enrolled patients with HER2 low, which is IHC, so patients would have HER2 IHC 1 plus or 2 plus with negative amplification on FISH. They had to have unresectable and or metastatic breast cancer that was treated with 1 to 2 prior lines of chemotherapy in the metastatic setting and had to be considered endocrine refractory if they had HR positive disease. This trial randomized patients 2 to 1 to either receive trastuzumab deruxtecan or standard of care chemotherapy, where patients receive capecitabine, eribulin, gemcitabine, paclitaxel, or nab-paclitaxel. Of note, as you will see here, majority of these patients were HR positive, and as well as, of course, being HER2 low. But they enrolled a small population, approximately 60% of triple negative patients. So I want to kind of make that note here as we start unpacking the data later. The primary endpoint of the study was PFS for the HR positive group. However, there are key secondary endpoints, which was PFS for all patients, including our triple negative patients now, as well as overall survival for the HR positive group, as well as for the entire cohort. So when we look at the progression, the data, I want to start by looking at a progression-free survival data. And what we will see here in the first box, we will see the data for HR positive, the patients that had HR positive disease. And you will see here a nice separation of the curve where patients that received T-DXd had a median PFS of 10.1 months compared to 5.4 months if they receive chemotherapy with a hazard ratio of 0.51. When we combine all the patients, we see here that it was pretty similar. T-DXd had a median PFS of 9.9 months compared to 5.1 months for the patients that received chemotherapy. Again, hazard ratio of 0.5. So very similar hazard ratio for HR positive as well as our patients, the overall cohort. And when we piece it out to the patients that just the triple negative cohort, we will again see a nice separation that was consistent. T-DXd 8.5 months compared to chemo 2.9, hazard ratio again of 0.46, very similar. So it seemed like we saw benefit for T-DXd in the favor of T-DXd compared to chemotherapy across both HR positive as well as triple negative, in both the triple negative and HR positive cohorts. And then, of course, the data that we always want to look for, did that pan out in as we look at overall survival? And what we saw here was that the overall survival data looked very similar again. So patients that received T-DXd in the HR-positive cohort had a median OS of 23.9 months compared to 17.5 months for patients that received chemotherapy with a hazard ratio of 0.64. In the entire cohort, that was also very similar, 23 months for T-DXd compared to 16.8 months for patients that received chemotherapy for a hazard ratio, again, of 0.64. And then when we looked at the triple negative cohort, we will see here that patients that received T-DXd had a median overall survival of 18.2 months compared to 8 months for patients that received chemotherapy with a hazard ratio of 0.48. So this is very significant data, very, very transformative as we think about the landscape of breast cancer. And I think this was truly revolutionary for the past year. As this new class of drug that we're now able to offer to all our patients. So now we will discuss the side effect profile. Of course, as we are talking about this new category of drugs, we have to always pay attention to side effects because some of these may be new side effects that we did not previously encounter with traditional chemotherapy. So the most common side effect noted was nausea, all grade being approximately 73%. However, to note, grade 3 was only in 5% of patients. Then when we think about fatigue, that was 50% all grade, but again, 8% had grade 3 fatigue. And that is in comparison to 42% all grade fatigue, as noted in the chemotherapy arm, and 5% grade 3. Then when I think about the chemotherapy arm here, as you will see, the most common side effect noted for the patients that received chemotherapy was neutropenia, all grade being 51%. And of note, grade 3 neutropenia that was seen in this study was also 41%. So definitely high rates of neutropenia compared to 33% in the T-DXd arm for all grade neutropenia and 14% grade 3 neutropenia noted with T-DXd. Dose reductions due to treatment-related adverse events was actually higher in the chemotherapy arm at 38% compared to 23% in patients that received T-DXd. And adverse events that led to treatment discontinuation was actually higher in the T-DXd arm, 16% compared to 8% in the chemotherapy arm. We do, however, have to mention ILD, which occurred in 12% of all patients that received T-DXd. Of note, however, that most of these patients either were grade 1 or grade 2, but there were ILD-related deaths that were noted across these DESTINY-Breast studies, and therefore we definitely have to have strategies in place to detect as well as to manage T-DXd-related ILD because that's truly essential to minimize risk and mortality from ILD, is really to screen to detect these cases early. So I want to spend some time talking about TDXD-related interstitial lung disease, or ILD, and just give a brief summary of the 5S rule that have been published in these papers here that you can use as a resource later. So screening. So of course, I mentioned earlier, we have to make sure that we're trying to think about our patient selection as we're thinking about patients that you're actually going to be treating with TDXD, really to make sure that you're having some monitoring strategies in place, and counseling your patients so they know what to look for. They know to let you know at the first sign that they're having shortness of breath or cough or any chest pain or any respiratory symptom, that they need to know that these are alarm symptoms that they should let you know about. Also, scanning. So we know that higher resolution CT scans are the way to go to pick up patients that have early signs of ILD. So a baseline scan is, of course, recommended, as we, do routinely, but we also want to make sure that we're repeating scans. Not only, of course, you'll be repeating scan for screen for surveillance to, just to make sure their disease is doing well, but also with that eye that you'll be monitoring to see if there are any early signs of ILD every 6 to 12 weeks is what's recommended. And then, of course, we know that we have to really have a multidisciplinary team with our pulmonologists or ID docs on board in case we have a patient that we're running into trouble with, to make sure that we are able to rule out other causes of respiratory symptoms that could be masquerading as ILD. And then we have to suspend treatment. On the first sign that this could be ILD, we have to just halt and restart only in the case that someone becomes asymptomatic. And then we know steroids is the backbone. So the mainstay of treatment has been steroids. So this is kind of one of those things that you want to make sure that you're using earlier rather than later. And again, these guidelines, you can refer to the citations here to read further. So wanted to switch gears to talk about a case discussion now. So this is a 56-year-old female that presented with de novo metastatic triple-negative breast cancer with a left-sided breast mass, with ipsilateral and large axillary lymph nodes, as well as a liver and lung signs of metastases. So the patient had biopsy of her breast and ipsilateral lymph nodes that showed that that was ER negative, PR negative, as well as HER2 was 1+ on IHC. Biopsy of the liver also confirmed metastatic triple-negative breast cancer, and her tumor was also found to be PD-L1 positive with a CPS score of 10 or higher. Germline testing, however, did not reveal a germline BRCA mutation. She did receive first-line paclitaxel plus pembrolizumab and had a good response, but after 8 months developed disease progression with growth of liver metastases. So the question is, what therapy would you now recommend? So the options here are olaparib, B, carboplatin, C, sacituzumab govitecan, D, trastuzumab deruxtecan, or E, capecitabine. So the debate here really is, do we choose between sacituzumab or trastuzumab deruxtecan? However, given the phase three data that I presented earlier from the ASCENT study supporting the use of sacituzumab with that overall survival advantage, which was statistically significant, it would be the choice given the level 1 evidence. However, we know that trastuzumab deruxtecan remains a good choice, especially given the data that I showed of DESTINY-Breast04. The data, however, not as robust if we think about the TNBC cohort that only had 58 patients with metastatic triple-negative breast cancer that were treated. So that study definitely had more HR-positive, HER2-low patients, but again, still a good choice, especially this patient was also HER2-low, so would not be a wrong answer. So the other case that we'll talk about briefly is a 36-year-old female that initially presented 2 years ago with a 3.5 centimeter left breast mass with an enlarged axillary lymph node. Breast biopsy revealed ER negative, PR negative, HER2 IHC 1 plus, so similar to that prior case. Invasive ductal carcinoma and FNA was positive for malignant cells. She received neoadjuvant dose-dense AC, followed by paclitaxel for 12 weeks. At surgery, she was found to have no evidence of disease, so she achieved a path CR, and germline testing was done, and she was indeed found to have a germline BRCA1 mutation. 2 years after surgery, however, she was found to have elevation in her transaminase, AST as well as ALT, and imaging did reveal liver enlarging liver mets. A biopsy of the liver was consistent with her breast biopsy that was done 2 years prior, and she also then had PD-L1 testing, which revealed a CPS score of 2, so PD-L1 was essentially negative. So the question here is, what therapy would you now recommend? The options being olaparib, which is a PARP inhibitor, carboplatin, sacituzumab govitecan, trastuzumab deruxtecan, paclitaxel, or carboplatin gemcitabine in addition to immunotherapy with pembrolizumab. So just to remind everyone, she is HER2 low, she's PD-L1 negative, and she has a germline BRCA1 mutation. So based on the data from the Olympia as well as the EMBRCA study, she I think here a good choice for this patient, given she has a germline BRCA1 mutation, would be olaparib, which is a PARP inhibitor. However, this patient, as mentioned, now is in the first line setting. So in the first line setting, we know that her trastuzumab deruxtecan does not have a first line indication, and sacituzumab deruxtecan also does not have a first line indication. So the options here, of course, immunotherapy would not be an option for her because she's PD-L1 negative. And I think the best option instead of standard chemotherapy would be to target that germline BRCA1 mutation with a PARP inhibitor. So she starts on olaparib and has a nice response for 12 months, but then has disease progression in her liver. What would you now recommend? Options now, trastuzumab deruxtecan, B, sacituzumab govitecan, C, paclitaxel, or paclitaxel with pembrolizumab. Here again, you could choose between sacituzumab or T-DXd. And data again favors sacituzumab given the level one evidence, but I think any of the ADCs in this space would not be wrong. So antibody drug conjugates in triple negative breast cancer have truly given us more tools in our toolbox. Now we don't only have standard traditional chemotherapy and, you know, PARP inhibitors for patients with germline BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutations, but we now have this novel class of drugs that are superior to chemotherapy where patients have better survival outcomes. But what is on the horizon when we think about ADCs? Are there any more ADCs coming, I think, is the question. And, you know, is this replacing chemotherapy as we see it for patients with metastatic triple negative breast cancer and perhaps even localized breast cancer? So there are some ADCs in drug development. As we see here, we see Dato-DXd, which again, similar, has a TROP2 target. We see HER3 targets as well. Again, I won't spend too much time going over that data, but we do see that there's some definite excitement when it comes to this space, where there's several ADC now that is currently in clinical trial, and hopefully we'll soon see more FDA approval and more options for our patients. So I do want to highlight some of the ongoing trials as it relates to ADCs, as we are now thinking about not only for patients in the metastatic setting, but their trials currently in the early setting. We see here ASCENT-05, where we are seeing that patients are going to be patients with residual triple negative breast cancer would receive adjuvant sacituzumab govitecan plus immunotherapy, and those patients will be compared to immunotherapy with pembrolizumab. pembrolizumab combined with capecitabine. So again, I think, you know, stay tuned for what that will yield with that data as we see, as we are start thinking, should these patients with these more resistant disease perhaps be benefit from antibody drug conjugates even earlier. And we, of course, see other trials such as the SASIA trial, which again is looking at patients with residual disease after neoadjuvant chemotherapy. Again, these patients will be randomized to either sacituzumab govitecan single agent compared to chemotherapy. And then the TROPION-Breast03 study is looking at another ADC, the Dato-DXd, combined with immunotherapy compared to immunotherapy plus capecitabine. So stay tuned as we look at, as we see in the coming years, what that data will yield. And of course, we have here the metastatic studies that are in the pipeline. So the critical question that we have is now, as we see not just one or two, but we see all the others that are coming, will ADCs work in sequence? Will one antibody drug conjugate work after another if they have non-cross-resistant payloads? Will one ADC work after another if they have the same target but different payloads? Another question that I think, we are seeing different studies that are trying to answer these questions in different ways. And, you know, will there be an optimal combination? So I showed earlier that, you know, we're trying to now see, can we combine immunotherapy with an antibody drug conjugate? So I think the field is quite exciting, as we now think, just from, you know, years ago, it was just chemotherapy. Then, of course, we saw the era of immunotherapy. Now we have ADCs. And how can we kind of combine all of what we have now to improve survival, especially for patients that have more resistant disease? So exciting as we think about, you know, all that we have to offer our patients. However, what I kind of want to spend the last couple minutes talking about is, despite all these advances in therapy, we know that the disparities persist. We have seen the updated data from SEER looking at how we're doing as it relates to survival outcomes. And what we see is that the disparities continue to persist despite all these novel therapeutics. And, you know, it really then makes us wonder, how do we delve down at figuring out how to improve care for Black women with triple-negative breast cancer? That way we can level the playing field. That way all our patients can have access to these novel therapeutics that have improved efficacy. So I want to take a moment to just highlight a critical thought that I really want to perhaps leave us with today. And it's focused on the right of this graph, the right side of this graph, where we already spoke about the fact that, you know, when we think overall now, so overall, we know that Black patients are less likely to get breast cancer. So that's overall. I know I mentioned earlier that Black patients are more likely to get triple negative breast cancer, but overall, less likely to get breast cancer. But we know, regardless of subtype of breast cancer, Black patients are 40% more likely to die from breast cancer. So that's what the left is showing. But when we look on the right of this slide, we see that in the 1980s, there was really no difference as it relates to mortality, right? We saw that when we compared Black versus white patients with the light and pink curves here, the mortality rates were, we saw that we were not doing a great job, right? However, when you look now since the 1980s, you will see a continued decline for white patients, as you see in the dark pink curve, where the mortality rate continues to decline. However, you will now see in the light pink curve, that's Black patients there, and you'll see that it almost even increased initially, but it's going down, but that curve, that widening, that disparity continues to persist, and even until the last data that I looked at, which was in 2019. So we see persistent disparities despite improved therapeutics. And I think it makes us, it really, we really have to stop and think, why is this happening? Why prior to the 1980s, we did not see any difference in outcomes? So there was no racial disparity as we know it. And what we know is that whenever there are therapeutic advances, and we know there are a lot of therapeutic advances in the 1980s, we knew how to screen patients. So we were detecting breast cancer earlier when we were able to cure more patients, when we're able to screen them before they had a palpable mass. We now know how to subtype breast cancer. So we were treating hormone positive patients with endocrine therapy. We now had the advent of endocrine therapy, tamoxifen, letrozole, et cetera. HER2 targeted therapy, when we were able to figure out how to treat HER2 targeted patients, HER2 positive patients, et cetera. So we figured out how to diagnose breast cancer more refinedly and then treat accordingly, and we're able to screen better and mortality started to decrease. But why did that not decrease for all patients, I think, is the concerning part. And what I want to leave you with is, whenever we have these novel ideas, so now we can screen, you know, we figured that out in the 1980s, but if we're not able to screen all our patients, if we're not able to go into the rural areas, if we're not able to screen patients because they don't have insurance, what will happen? The patients that we can screen will have better outcomes. And then, of course, we keep seeing that widening of that get curve, because you're able to offer one patient that optimal therapy and the other patient really will just stay where they are. And then you will see this widening of that gap. My worry is that with these novel therapies, such as antibody drug conjugates, which I just showed you how we see those widening of the curves as it relates to improvement in outcomes, PFS as well as OS, if we're not able to offer those novel therapies, these novel antibody drug conjugates, olaparib, PARP inhibitors for patients with germline BRCA1 mutations, we perhaps will further see the widening of these curves if we're not careful enough to make sure we get these drugs into the hands of all our patients. So with that, I want to play a small clip as we talk about some patient experiences as it relates to their journey with breast cancer, specifically triple-negative breast cancer.
I feel my oncologist loves me in a category. If you were African-American, you had this type of breast cancer, whatever, this was your treatment. I happen to be the person that they needed for the trial. You know, it wasn't so much that, you know, he wanted to give that to me. But, you know, I feel filled in a box.
That is just one patient's experience that had metastatic breast cancer. And, you know, what I heard from that was, that patient felt like they were in a box and did not get that care that they would have hoped to have received. The other quotation here I want to kind of highlight this page. So many times African Americans are closed-lipped about chronic diseases, especially cancer. I think that one of the things we as a community need to address is our ability to share information about our health situations with our family, with our friends, and with the greater community, if at all possible. And hearing patient voices, I always think, is so important as we start strategizing different novel ideas and innovations, how we can try to really delve down and trying to offer equitable care. You can, of course, you know, read more about this study and scan this QR code to be able to listen to more patient experiences. So then, how can we improve breast cancer care for Black patients? So I think we really have to have more increased efforts at early detection. So better screening, making sure that we are not only doing screening, but reviewing family history to identify patients that are at risk that perhaps would benefit from even earlier age of screening. So we want to make sure that we're delving into that, because we just mentioned that Black patients, of course, not only have a higher incidence of triple negative breast cancer, but are also diagnosed at younger ages. And I think this is a simple one, but something that bears repeating, that I think we have to be mindful to provide guideline concordant care for all our patients, regardless of age. And that goes from the entire spectrum of care that patients receive, not just standard of care, but also clinical trial, especially in a type of breast cancer that is overrepresented among a certain population with worse mortality, we have to try to understand why that's happening and include these patients in the in clinical trials as we try to understand different biological processes that could be contributing. I think one of the biggest struggles that we have seen from prior studies is a lot of treatment delays correlate with worse outcomes. So what can we do to prevent these treatment delays or as early as screening? Because sometimes patients get into screening, but then they have a delay in getting that diagnostic biopsy, perhaps, that is what they need to start treatment. And then, of course, we have to make sure that we're not only getting a patient started on treatment, but if that patient is eligible for germline or next generation sequencing to find that PD-L1 mutation that would then allow them access to receive pembrolizumab, we need to make sure that patients are receiving all different levels of care. So from somatic testing, germline testing, and then access to novel therapeutics and novel ADCs as we now have access. And really what all of that comes down to is truly addressing structural barriers. So we have to make sure that we're promoting access to high quality care. And maybe we have to start thinking about what is it that prevents this patient in front of me from receiving that high level care? Do I need to perhaps have a translator in the room to make sure that that patient understands what we're understands their treatment plan, or perhaps getting that clinical trial consent translated into Spanish, that way that patient is allowed or able to be a part of that study, but not just assuming that the patient would not be interested. We know that diversifying the workforce has shown to be effective, as patients do relate better with their, when they can identify with that person of for that race or ethnicity. So again, those are some strategies that we have been talking about for quite some time and perhaps need to really think about more, not just providers, but also in the clinical trial research staff. And then we can't emphasize enough addressing some of these social determinants of health that cripples patients from being able to access the healthcare system a lot of times. Insurance, just where you live, your zip code, and what you're able to receive as it relates to care. So how can we increase participation in clinical trials? So some of the actions from the Become Project looked at maybe four tidbits, so to speak. So one, we know, just inform patients, just ask, right? 83% of Black patients with metastatic breast cancer would consider a trial, but 40% of patients reported that no one on the care team had even discussed a trial with them. And I think that's disappointing. We also have to inspire trust. Black patients were more likely than non-Black patients to want to learn about clinical trials from someone with shared experience. Black respondents were more likely than non-Black respondents to value receiving trial information with someone with their same race and from their same race or ethnic group. That was 67%, and that was in comparison to 10% of the non-Black respondents. So it definitely mattered more for Black patients to have someone that they could identify with. So we really need to work on trust in the Black community. And then we have to ensure access. Common barriers that patients will report were logistics, finding that trial, or the expenses that came with a trial, the transportation, the trial not being in their community, and them having to travel long distances to get to that medical center are things that we all have to think about as we're thinking about where it is that we're putting our clinical trials. And then we have to address these address concerns, right? We need to communicate clearly about issues that Black patients worry about and reasons that motivate or demotivate their willingness to clinical trials. So really having a listening ear and then addressing the concerns that patients in your community may be dealing with. I can't not talk about implicit bias, because I think that's something that as providers, all of us have to make sure that we're checking ourselves to make sure that there's nothing that we need to think about that could be allowing us then not to offer trials to all our patients, regardless of race or ethnicity, and regardless of a patient's socioeconomic status. We really need to be making sure that we're offering a clinical trial to all patients and not allowing our implicit bias to get in the room to prevent us from offering a patient a clinical trial. So, and you know, that's that Project Implicit. So I would highly recommend that you all look at that. That's an implicit association test. And I think we all could benefit from doing that, not just once, but ever so often, to remind ourselves to just be sensitive that we all have biases that we have to address and have to work through, and make sure that that's not standing in the way of you offering optimal care. So I want to leave us with some next steps and our goals as we think about achieving equitable care for all our patients. So again, you know, I won't repeat too much, but we mentioned it earlier, but I think it bears repeating as we wrap up, to make sure that we're truly providing guideline concordant care for all our patients, regardless of race. Make sure that we're offering all our patients both germline as well as somatic testing when appropriate, identifying and then addressing our own biases, and reflecting on these. And maybe it's every day you're in clinic, or even before every encounter, we're really trying to make sure that we're sensitive of those biases when they crop up. And then listen to your patients and consider their concerns, especially as it relates to clinical trial. There may be trust issues there that may need some delving, some working through. And especially when you start talking about novel therapies that they may not have heard anyone on before, such as novel antibody drug conjugates, it may take some time to kind of going through what these drugs are, what the side effect profiles are, maybe even pulling up these studies to really get down to the level that may be popping up some of these concerns, and trying to kind of address these concerns as they come up. And then not only address our own biases, but also speak up when you see explicit or implicit bias affecting cancer care around you. I think we have to be the advocates for our patients. And this is, you know, identify a SMART goal, perhaps, to address disparities in this triple negative breast cancer care in our own environments. And I know that will differ depending on where we're practicing. And this is just an example. So in summary, we know that the incidence of triple negative breast cancer is twofold higher for Black patients compared to their white counterpart. We know that clinical trial participation is lowest among Black patients. However, willingness to participate, if offered the opportunity, does not differ by race. There is a complex and multifactorial relationship between the biological as well as socioeconomic causes of disparities, including disparities seen in triple negative breast cancer. We do know that the landscape for metastatic triple negative breast cancer is evolving, and this is exciting, and it's an exciting time to be treating patients with breast cancer, because we're able to offer patients therapies that truly work. Antibody drug conjugates and the two discussed today, sacituzumab govitecan and trastuzumab deruxtecan, have both shown potential to extend the life in the second line setting for patients with triple negative breast cancer. Hopefully, we'll soon see the utilization of these drugs in earlier settings. Sacituzumab was similar, and I think that's an important point to notice, that the efficacy of this drug was no different across race. So doesn't seem to have any differences when we look at progression-free survival or overall survival by race and ethnicity. Definitely not something that this study was powered to look at. But nonetheless, we did not see any differences when we looked at the patients that identified as Black in the ASCEND trial. We do know that we have to pay attention to ILD for patients that are receiving trastuzumab deruxtecan to minimize the risk of complications from that. The 5S rules is a good cheat sheet to look at, and the resource will be shared. We know now that HER2-low is not a new subtype characterized by an oncogenic driver, but is rather a biomarker for benefit to antibody drug targets that target that HER2 antigen. Despite advances in therapy, however, we know that disparities persist. So as healthcare workers, I think what we have to make sure is that we treat all our patients equitably and make sure that all our patients have equal access to new therapies that can extend their life, because that's what we're talking. It's really down to this is sometimes life or death for our patients. And we have to make sure that patients are able to access these novel therapies. So with that, I will end, and I thank CEC and Gilead for sponsoring this talk as we try to unpack actionable strategies in community oncology to achieve equity in triple-negative breast cancer. Thanks for your time.